Well, thank you very much. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. Glad she told me what I was supposed to be talking about. I'll prepare real quick. only been preparing forever. I'm going to talk about that and God knows what else. For one, thanks for a good deal here this weekend. I've been really impressed with how well the group is tuned in to the agenda. And that's always good to see. I've enjoyed a little bit of hanging out between meetings, not nearly as much as I want to. Oh, and by the way, I'm supposed to give you a piece of information. Dick said he was too poor to get any copying done, so we're going to settle for email. And if you don't have email, get a neighbor to do it. But I'll give you two addresses. One is my email address, and I've also got some cards. If you don't have anything to write on, just swing by. You catch me walking the hall somewhere, and I've got cards that's got everything in there. Social Security, bank deposit. So we got it covered one way or the other. And I'll send you that thing on David. I appreciated the show of interest in that because I think it is a compelling story and one that's too often repeated and way too often repeated. And I wanted to use that to kick off because it is so relevant to what we're talking about. It is how these steps produce a new life. So and I also want to just briefly comment on that light thing. That is absolutely, Dick got so carried away, he drove in the lake almost. That is spectacular. I tell you, and I was just tremendously impressed with who on earth designed and engineered and put that together so it works beautifully and with precision. That is absolutely outstanding stuff. And so I'm grateful that I got a chance to see that. And also got a chance to eat at the Mountain House. No, Old Country House up the road here. First thing up the road here to eat at that was not moving. Then I thoroughly enjoyed that. So it's just been a good stay. And a real quick little snippets of some tourist-like stuff. And I suggested to somebody that, I don't know who, but somebody that I thought would get something done. Somewhere over there is a beautiful, beautiful chapel that is older than Bill Roop. Yeah. Well, maybe not that old, but it's old. It's an old chapel, beautifully, beautifully maintained. And I thought, what a great place that would be at a deal like this if a small bunch wanted to get together, do an 11-step meeting, third-step meeting or something like that, or just a little quiet meditation. Great place, beautiful, just beautiful. So, now that's all the travelogue. Now I'm supposed to be talking about 8 and 9, which I am. Yes, that's something? What?
Email.
Oh. Well, minor oversight. It is Tommy at Pinehurst. And that's with a U, Pinehurst. .net. Yeah, I had to think about that last part of it. .net. Tommy at Pinehurst.net. And so anything close to that will usually get in. A lot of stuff I don't want. So by all means, feel free to use that. I'm going to send a copy to Dick, and if you get mine and you know his, he'll have some available through his email here in Atlanta, which is written by
@mindspring.com.
Mindspring's what happened just before he drove in the lake. Mindspring. Well, about once a year, I want to kind of just tease into the 8 and 9. About once a year, a group of guys in my sponsorship line in North Carolina, we get together with no formality. We just pick a place to meet, and we meet. Usually it'll last a half day. And one of the last ones we had was on step 6 and 7. And you would think when you first read those steps, as short as they are, that you couldn't spend 30 minutes on them. We spent a half a day and still weren't through. But I think we recognize the criticality of those steps because they really are the turning point. You know, it's the place where you're through with the admission and taking stock of who you are, taking a look at the causes and conditions that drive this weird apparatus. And then it's decision time. You want to get well or don't you? And that's the turning point. That's where David never made the turn. It's where he settled for just survival, and that was his business. And unfortunately, it ran out. So that 6 and 7 to me are tremendously important steps. And get ready for the process. When I look at 8 and 9, to me they're the freedom steps. I think Bob used that term. They're the freedom steps. Because that, I'll say just one other thing introductory wise. I went to my first international in 65. My primary motivation for going was I wanted to meet Bill. I didn't have a message for him or anything. I just wanted to see him, I guess, because he was so large in my vision that I just wanted to make sure there was really somebody there, you know. So I went up there and I wanted to see him and not talk to him, just be with him. And of course, he's like the Energizer Bunny, man. He was everywhere. You see him a lot, but there's always 10,000 people around. And so we had a tradition meeting. And would you believe it was small? You could almost meet in a phone booth. Maybe all you got to do is announce tradition. You might as well announce fire. And if folks start running. And so there were only about 30, 35 of us in a room. And I listened to Bill talk about, he had a topic, but it didn't bother him. He was a lot like me. I mean, you tell me what you want me to do, and then we'll get to it one way or another. That's the way Bill was. And so he wove around. He talked about anonymity. And then he talked about these steps, about 8 and 9, and one of the vital things that he wanted to point out. He said, if you really take the action that are laid out and do those steps thoroughly, you'll be amazed because you'll be able to look the world in the eye anywhere you go on earth. And I was about up to kneecaps at that point. I was 8 years sober, I think. Something like, 8 years. And I was about to kneecaps. And I thought, come on now. You know, but the guy told the truth. The guy told the truth. And I'm one who fully believes that what we uncovered in the inventory and even the things that we don't get to in the inventory are things that don't go away. They don't die of old age. You know, defects of character don't age out. They stay alive and vibrant and functional to the end. And so what we do is either deal with them or drag them. One or the other. We drag them because they don't go away. And so we drag them as long as we're willing to or till they drag us down. And so I think that's what underlines the importance of 8 and 9, because it's where we start to repair that wreckage of the past and start to do the things that unravel those defects of character that drive my boat in such a strange pattern. And so they're tremendously, tremendously important steps. I'm going to talk about an aspect of in the course of this, I'm going to talk about an aspect of a man's that I don't normally do in a regular talk. It's not because I avoid it, but because it's difficult, and without taking an adequate amount of time, you can't really address it. Like I was responsible for 2 human beings losing their life, directly responsible. Now, those are things that obviously don't go away and never will. But there are things that these steps can address. And so I'm going to talk about that here because we're spending a little bit of time on that. And some others. You know, now I'm not a causation freak, but neither am I a village idiot. And I don't think I bought my alcoholism in a bootleg joint. I believe that my alcoholism was, obviously I learn what I live. And I'm a great believer that I learn what I live. And so my experience, and I won't go into a whole bunch of it, but I was like many, many other, most people in AA. I grew up in such a way, and every human being goes through an experience of taking a few shots here and there. And as a child and growing up, I took a few shots that were difficult, when you get a shot, there's 2 ways to deal with it. One is to respond and take action to deal with it appropriately. The other is to react and then internalize it. So I did more of the latter than the former. And so when I ran into the bumps and bruises of life and, my dad left when I was 4 years old. Never saw it except twice on the street. And it might as well have been introduced to the apple polisher or something. It was a totally meaningless thing. So he was never a factor in my life. I grew up and never had a serious conversation with a man till I was a grown man. Well, that has some sort of lingering effects. And when you're deserted, you be as academic as you want to about it, but when a father walks out on a four-year-old kid, that is not without impact. And so what forms out of that kind of stuff, that what I alluded to last night, that sort of brittle, broken relationship with organized religion. You know, that was as a child. And that's a kind of weight of guilt that you carry, you know, you try to ignore, but it's always there because it's a nagging doubt, fear, and all that kind of stuff. And, so those things just sort of stay there and they have their impact in life. I'll tell you just one other thing that I want to deal with a little bit too in a minute that grew out of that. When my, why I'm drinking so much. It's because I got a lot. I'm drinking out of both bottles. He says, one bottle enough, so I've got two. Man, trying to confuse me. No wonder he drove in that lake. Tell you the other thing grew out of that. Now, my mother was a great mother. She tended to overdo it a mite, but she was a great mother. And a big woman. I mean, she was big. She wouldn't argue with people. She'd fight you. I mean, she'd flat go at you. And so she was a tough woman. Had to be. And when my dad left, she brought another one in. And I know that'd be all day if I get into this too much. I'll just tell you just enough you can sort of see the picture. She brought in a little old runt of a guy, and you talk about follically impaired. He was not follically impaired. He was vertically impaired. I mean, tremendously so. And my mother's big woman, she brought this dwarf in, and well, almost compared to her, and that was going to be my new daddy. I hated that dude the minute he walked in. I mean, he was just an obscene, vulgar man. I don't mean his language, just himself. He would just shake hands with me, you won't take a bath. I mean, he just a gross, gross guy. And I flat didn't like that boy. I was just a little kid. My sister was 7 years older than me at the time. We're now identical twins, owing to her lying. When he came in, his name was Alvin. It fit. It just absolutely fit. Nobody ever said, "Where'd you get that name?" I mean, just look at him. You'd have named him the same thing. And Alvin. So she called that thing Alvin, and I had to call it Daddy. God knows. Now, I'm talking about a little guy. But every time I'd call that sucker Daddy, I mean, my ears would burn. And I swore if I ever got big enough, I was going to beat him like a drum. And then I went off to the Army and I came back. I was too big. Can't be beating up a dwarf. And so I never did get to whipping. He died, and the best thing I can say about him, he's buried over in the end of South Carolina somewhere. I go by once in a while and make sure he hadn't clawed out, you know. Now, some people would call that a resentment. To the untrained eye, it would sound that way, but Bob say that you don't justify them. They just are. I don't even like him dead. I tell you, I really don't. But he's gone, you know, and I literally am out of it. But, just that kind of stuff. And if you can see, well, what I grew up in essentially, in terms of who I related to, I grew up in a maternal world. And I had a mother and an older sister, and they were the only really meaningful people in my life. Now, that's nice. I like women. Married to one. And 41 years at poor soul. But I've got her. So I grew up in that maternal house. Now, that's good, except there's something women can't do very well, like teach a boy how to go to the bathroom. Doesn't work. They don't do it right. You know, they argue over the lids where it's going to be and all that. But it's kind of troubling to a boy trying to figure out. And more seriously, it's very troubling when you grow up and living in a maternal world. And part of the drag and why those amends go so deeply is that when you're around other boys, you find yourself very awkwardly unable to communicate at the same kind of stuff they're talking about. They talk about things they've done with their dad. You got nothing to say, you know, except feel, awkward, embarrassed, and so forth. So all of those things that are the seed beds of alcoholism that we call defects of character that just really drive my life in a warped kind of way are deep and troubling, and they don't go away. They just simply get worse. That other thing about growing up in a female world, it's you got to kind of figure out somewhere along the line whether you're he or she, you know. And some people never do get out of that. And I don't know how I got into it, but I was in some sort of a seminar. I don't know what I was even doing there, but it was a psychiatrist that was speaking about the incidence of latent homosexuality in male alcoholics. Well, I'd heard that stuff before, but there was a guy with me, about 20-year member, good friend, who had never heard it. And he was just absolutely enthralled with it. He's sitting there listening. I mean, he was taking that in like it was the end of time coming. You know, I mean, he was really taking it in. And I got a devious mind. That's probably a defect of character as well. But he was caught up. I sort of gently reached over and took his hand. I could still see it, man. You could almost see the current going to his brain saying, he's holding your hand. And when he realized that, he just leaped out of his chair right in the middle of the lecture. And man, he started talking to me ugly for real and loud. And everybody in the room was just hooting. And they had to call a break, and they never got the class back in. I caught up with him after God saw he's all right. I caught up with him and I said, what's the matter? Did I hit a nerve? he started again. Anyway, those things are just they're troubling, and they're a whole part of what gets that thing so that a drink feels so good because it puts all that stuff to rest. Yeah. So those defects of character that set in. It's kind of like what happened to David and the countless people I've seen do the same thing of just getting to the point where you start to get into the healing, into the recovery, and then opt out and settle for just hanging out and shooting the breeze with people and last till it lasts. Now, I've known people who've done that who died sober. The old boy where I used to live in Raleigh, I think he had a name, but everybody called him Fish. He looked like a fish. I mean, he just was a sour, puckered up guy, you know. And he always greeted newcomers by saying, you know, I never have read that book. Well, he didn't have to tell you that very often. I mean, you could tell that he'd missed something pretty badly. Namely, the program. And he just looked that way. And so, to me, this is what six is about. Where you decide, do you want to just get by not drinking and hanging on? And if so, fine, it's an option. But do you want to have peace? Do you want to have joy? Do you want to have a new life? Do you want real recovery? Do you want to be able to be a responsible person? You want to be able to enjoy life. You know, you want to be able to be of service and have the feedback that comes from having a life built on giving instead of taking all the time. And so, to me, that's what this crossroads is about. And 6 and 7, for me, were huge steps. And I knew when I got to them, I wanted to get better. But I didn't want to get good. And when I read those things, I thought, man, I'm going to have to be John the Baptist if I do this. And I'll never smile again, I'm sure, that all of my defects, what's left? Very little. And so I was very, very undecided about that stuff. And then finally, what I decided was that I was sick and tired of being the town clown. I was sick and tired of being the butt of jokes. I was sick and tired of being humiliated. Wouldn't let anybody know it. Embarrassed, disappointed, disgusted, absolutely just giving up on life. I was tired of that. I was tired of that kind of rat race that was my life. And I truly wanted to be a different guy. And that's the reason I did the 6 and 7 step. And to me, there's, I won't elaborate on it, but there's, you know, in 6, we're talking about entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And that means I'm ready to change. And then 7 is humbly asking to remove our shortcomings. And some people toy around with the language. I kind of like to think of it in terms, there's a biblical kind of a thing where we talk about sins of omission and sins of commission. And to me, defects of character are what are measured by the commission. Those are the actions I did. Those are the things I took that were hurtful to other people, to whom I will owe amends. And the sins of omission are the things I failed to do. Like when I first came into the program and started looking at what the steps were about, one of the conclusions I made was that, well, at least, I know I'm the only alcoholic AA's ever done this, but I said, well, at least I didn't hurt my family. I had the decency to be gone. And so my mother spent most of my life, until I was well into my adulthood, not even knowing whether she had a son or not. That's no damage, is it? Probably nothing more important to a mother than their child. And most of the time, in my active alcoholic days, she never knew what state I was in, or whether alive or dead. So the damage is measured many different ways. And so, you know, I knew that I had a lot of things when I got to that step, and I truly wanted to do something about it. And I wanted, that's the sin of omission. As much as anything else, there were plenty of the other two. But those are things that when I got to that point, I knew I had a load of stuff that I needed to deal with. And so when I got into to the amends process, very honestly, I got into thinking amends, I didn't call it that, before I ever heard of AA. You know, when I came to, and many in here know my story, and my story could have been yours, and I know that. That I came to in jail one morning and greeted with the fact that I had blind, drunk, blacked out, driving down a main street of a city, struck 2 young people trying to cross the street. And they died. And so even as a human being, never mind AA, never mind any thoughts of a different life, just as a human being, I knew that I needed to do something. And I also knew that that would not be easy to do, because I'm talking about dealing with 2 families that have lost the most important thing in the world. I had somebody to contact the families and ask them if they would be willing to hear from me. Both families adamantly said no. Well, you got to accept that. You know, the book says you can't find your relief at somebody else's expense, eh? And so I was well aware of that. But when I got, that would never leave. That would never leave. It would never leave my mind 24 hours a day. I truly wanted to do it, but how to do it. And it's an amazing thing with, I'll spend a little time on this and then talk about some others that are pretty important to me. That one was a compelling kind of a thing that I needed to deal with. Even before I got into AA, I needed to deal with it, but didn't know how. And then when I got into AA, I started to see that there were indeed true tools. There are two sets of amends that need to be made. One to the victims who were dead. Obviously, there are limits to how much you can do. But there are things that you can do. And by the way, anybody that's got any kind of a history like this, if you're hung up on that thing, let me know and I'll be glad to talk with you about it, because it's a tough, tough thing to deal with. Some of the most tortured people I ever meet are people in AA conferences who will come to me privately and tell me about having done something similar or the same and never being caught. The most tortured people I know. So anybody get in trouble with that, you just contact me and I'll be glad to talk with you about it, because it's a tough road. So when I got in and started, got through my inventory, got in through 6 and 7, started ready to go to take amends, tell you what I did, and this is the way I still do it to this day when I'm taking people through the book. My 8th step list is pretty easy. I take a legal pad and draw 3 lines on it. 3 lines. First line is who or what has been injured. You know, who or what, whether it's a person, an institution, or whatever. That, you know, organized religion, for example, was one that showed up on my list because of the obvious reason, just what I've said. Who's been, and what I like to do is be extremely specific. Instead of just putting mom, I want to put her name, Rosa Ivester. I want to put the full name, so I know exactly who I'm talking about. I want to identify it specifically and not in some general kind of term. And if it's a victim, I want to name the victim and exactly who they are. I want to make it personal as I can make it. In the second line, I want to identify the harm. What is it that specifically? Like in the case of my mother, I had a page long of the stuff, but I want to list them individually so that I can take specific action to deal with that particular event. What I found is that global guilt is universally around in AA. And global guilt is totally useless, and it's unfixable. But it's a good place to just sort of hide to avoid action. But it doesn't lead anywhere. So that's why I want to get real specific with that stuff and list exactly what was the harm. Now, just telling my mother didn't know where I was for years, that's not clear enough. You know, I like to itemize things. Like my mother and sister worked in a cotton mill. And that's about one step removed from cotton field. They are not a lot different, though. I tell you what, either one of them pretty bad news. And I remember one time I'd go in to their home once in a while just to lick my wounds and heal up. That's what I'd do. I'd just come in there, take advantage of them, stay there till I got healed up, then go fight some more. And I remember one time I went in, and my mother was working night shift. Excuse me, night shift in that cotton mill. And I said, Mom, I need to use your car. I won't be gone long. I just got to make a quick run uptown, and then I'll be back. Three or four days later, I came back. For 3 or 4 days, she had walked to work. Sorry about that. I don't have the hiney flu. I got a little bronchial condition and it acts up. That's why I'm drinking so much. Maybe I'll get it wetted down a little bit. But now that's a very specific harm, eh? That's very specific harm. That was a terribly cruel and thoughtless thing to do to somebody. But that's something that hangs with you, you know. And so there were a lot of, and that's what I like to do, is be very clear about what I'm talking about. Then I can design an action, because the third line says, what can I do to make it right? So before I ever try to do an amends, that's exactly what I want. I want a real script that tells me what I'm dealing with. so I don't get into a lot of maudlin, emotional stuff that's just about, geez, I've been a bad guy all my life. No. Now, I want to narrow it down to specific things so I can deal with it. And then doing that, you know, like in that process, you know, the people who died in the accident, I named them specifically. And then when you know, obviously what the harm was, you know, ended their lives. You know, what can I do to make it right? Obviously, there's limits to that. Yeah, but there are things to do. And what I did for a good while in AA was hungrily listen to anything anybody said that even rhymed with that. Anything they could think of. And I never did ask many questions because not very many people have experience, thank God, in that. But I listened hungrily to that and heard. And so I did. Everything I heard that made any sense whatsoever, I tried. Wrote letters directly to them. Prayed with their faces, their images, right in my face. And then it occurred to me that there is such a thing as indirect amends. You don't always have to make direct amends. Because like the step says, we do this wherever possible. Wherever possible, except when they do so, it injures them or others. Some people say them or others includes me. It does not. Does not. There's nothing in the amends process that includes me except the reward of doing it. And so I found a route. And so I was able, even it locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary, I was able to start making amends. You know, even in that, was able to start making amends. Now, it'll go on forever, I'm sure. Because, I'll elaborate just a little bit more. Well, I'll go ahead now. I tell you, it's amazing how the avenues open up when you're open and looking for it. I was able to do a fair amount, you know, just indirectly, like I was talking about while I was confined. And when I got out, you know, what's happened over the years is that unbelievably, that accident happened on May 3rd. And I couldn't begin to tell you the number of things that I've been able to do on the 3rd of May that directly related to that amends. And none of them engineered by me. None whatsoever. I made a movie on drunk driving one time on the 3rd of May. Guy interviewing me didn't know I had done that. He didn't know anything about it. He didn't know anything about the date or anything else. Made a movie. It was a public broadcast, I think the television is what they put it on. I've never seen it, but they assured me it was anonymous. They used that Rubik's Cube technique, you know, where they sort of, that's what it looks like to me, the sort of moving colored block. Said it's to be impossible for anybody to identify you. You don't want to underestimate alcoholics. A woman was sometime later, a woman called me from North Dakota, and she said, "Tom, did you make a movie?" I said, "Have you lost your mind?" "No, I haven't made a movie, for God's sake. What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, I saw this thing," and she started describing it. I said, "Oh, yeah. I didn't call it a movie. That was an interview on a television station, anonymously done, with assurance that nobody on earth, including my mother, could identify it. And here's this woman in North Dakota. She said, "I knew that was you." "Well, how did you tell?" She said, "I recognized your nose." "My God, is it that bad?" She said, "Pretty rough." But that happened, you know. And they wanted to give me money. I said, "No, donate it to the Council on Alcoholism. You know, it'd be fine. Yeah, do that." I spoke to 5,000 young people one day in two groups of 2,500 on the 3rd of May. I didn't plan it. Just happens. Just on and on. There's no end to it of the number of things that directly relate. There's no doubt about it. As you've probably gathered from what some of my buddies are saying, I'm an extremely busy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the understatement of the year. And there's no question that part of my zeal comes from the amends process. Because obviously there's only so much I can do directly in that situation. But what I can do is maybe make a difference with somebody else. So no question that that's a part of the scenario for things that I do. It's not a guilt trip. It's an amends trip. And it's just a part of this world of service. So tremendous. The point is that there are tremendous opportunities, even in a case like that. I tell you about the families, and the amazing thing about when you got a boss man named God, amazing what happens. Now, both families had signaled to me very clearly that they didn't want to hear from me. And you got to honor that, eh? You got to honor it. But you don't have to forget it. And so, and I did something. I don't tinker with steps. But I added one word to the eighth step. It says, make a list of people who've harmed to become willing to make amends to them all. Right behind willing, I just sort of wrote in the word opportunity. And so what I prayed for was willingness and opportunity. I never knew if it would ever happen. And I absolutely did nothing to make it happen because I had to respect their request to not bother them. When I got out of the institution, I'd probably been out a couple of years maybe, and I got a phone call one day. It was from a lawyer in the state of Michigan and where the event occurred. And he identified himself, and he said that they had that the families had entered a lawsuit, and it was not directed at me. It was built on the notion that what happened really wasn't my fault, that the young people had jumped back to avoid another vehicle and jumped into mine. Well, you can imagine what my mind did just instantaneously. Thank God, you know, and just because it's relief. But that lasted about a second because when reality spoke up and said, that doesn't change anything, nothing whatsoever. Doesn't mitigate 1 ounce anything that happened. Because what I did was totally irresponsible. And if I'd been halfway conscious, I could have avoided the situation. So it didn't change anything. But he said that's what was going on. And he said, the families of the victims would like for you to come up and testify. I said, well, I mean, I'd be happy to do anything. But I've got no testimony. I couldn't even testify at my own trial. I did. I mean, they put me on a witness stand. They asked me questions. All I can say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. And that's the truth. That's the hell of blackouts. You know, if somebody came to you and said, you know what you did September 1st? And if you were a guy with blackouts, the best you could say is, I'm sorry, I don't know about that. I don't know. And that's what I testified. And I knew that's all I could testify there. So I told him that I don't really think it'd be helpful. He said, but they would like for you to come. I'll be there. Wasn't thinking opportunity. So I went up there, walked in. If you can picture this, I walked into the same courtroom I was tried in. Eerie feeling, eh? Eerie feeling. Walked in. The two families were seated over on the right side of the courtroom. They sat me just at the edge of where they were. And, of course, I was, every moment was electric. I'm trying to see what's happening. And I made my when they called me to the stand, I made my statement. I'm sorry, I don't know. And, Now, don't ask me to explain it. I'm sure there's a lawyer in the crowd, but I won't embarrass you by asking you to stick your hand up. I know there's some here, and if there is and you know them, they'll tell you that what happened ain't legal. But I've noticed that my boss doesn't have exactly the same law books as everybody else. I've got enough sense to know that what was done is not supposed to be done. And so we're going through the trial. Or hearing, and the judge, you know how the judge will call a recess to take the attorneys back to talk law. They go back, and the bailiff came over to the families and motioned for them to come on. I thought it was potty break. And so he took them down the hall. Then he came back, and he came over to me and said, come on down the hall. Well, I thought he'd offer me the same courtesy. And so I go down. Now, I'm the guy that's been praying for opportunity, eh? Now, I didn't mean all at once. You know, I wanted time to prepare. And I'd only been preparing about 6 or 8 years. And we walked down. This is as illegal as can be. Go to the bank on that. We walked back to a door. He opens the door and beckons for me to go in. I step up to the door, and here are both families alone. You ever been so shocked that it just looked like a giant flash bulb went off? I mean, that's what I saw that picture, and I said, oh, my God, to myself. And my first thought was, run, run, because it was not go get them, you know, and no way. And I thought, well, looks like your prayer had been answered. Went in, the first family, I still can't believe it, could not have been more warm and receptive if it had been my own family. Totally forgiving, and I wasn't even asking for that. Wasn't asking for anything. They just welcomed me into the family group, and we talked to me, and they were loving. They were a loving family. It was as if they were my own. And I still find it hard to believe, but it's exactly what happened. And then the other family was over in the other corner. They weren't together. And went over there, and this was a first-generation immigrant family from Eastern Europe. And they were a pretty stark family, and it was a patriarchal family. And so they were in a family circle. And when I walked up, the father stepped out of the circle and intercepted me. And so I went over, and we shook hands, and he knew we knew who each other were. And I said, could I speak with the family? He said, no, speak with me. So, excuse me, they had already talked about that. So I said, okay. So I talked with him, and I said everything that I wanted to say to him. And he went back into the family circle. And then he came back out, and he said, sorry, we can't forgive. Now, that wasn't what I was asking for. But he said, we can't forgive. Please don't bother us again. Well, I'm still at that point. Still pray for opportunity. If I get it, I'll take it in a heartbeat. But it may never happen. But in amends, it's important that I make the effort. The outcome is not the only qualifier for the value of the amends. It's my reaching out. Because in reality, amends are not about the other people. Certainly, that's a component. But they're really about me. They're about me getting those things that just eat me alive day after day. They're about the things that eat my lunch on a regular basis. They're about the things I wish I could forget, or they wouldn't wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's what it's about. It's about my side of the street, as it's put in the literature. It's about my side of the street. So in that way, in that sense, it's a very tough-minded kind of a thing. You know, naturally, if you can have a loving resolution and a happy ending, it's great. But just be able to make the amends, tremendously important. Now, that was obviously the hardest one that I've ever had to deal with. But I've never had any that were easy. I had, obviously, I think every other one was easier to approach. But I don't know what about you, but what I've run into in making amends is that almost everybody to whom I owed amends didn't want to hear it. Didn't want to hear it. They find it embarrassing and awkward and clumsy to deal with. And nearly always they'll want to say something like, no, 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 you don't need to do anything with me. Just keep doing what you're doing. Well, all that means is that I'm dealing with a nice person. Has nothing to do with amends. It's just a nice person. So that's not enough. Most of the people that I've done amends to or with, I've had to make them enter the process. I've had to make them. The first one I made when I left the institution, I had a boss when I got thrown out of the military. I had a guy that hired me, and like I mentioned last night, I guess, that I was a study in contrast. I either looked like a world beater or the world had landed on me, one or the other. I mean, there was no middle ground for me. And I went to work for a company. I was named Salesman of the Year in the city of Charlotte and fired the same year. But this guy, he was a nice man, a truly nice man. And I didn't stick it to him bad, but I got him to, whatever you call it. I hadn't borrowed money for so long. I forgot what you call it. The guy that signed, what do you call him? Sucker? Oh, cosigner. Yeah, cosigner. Not a sucker. And so he had signed for me to borrow some money. There wasn't a national debt, you know, but it was a little piece of money. He was a good guy. And of all the people I ripped off, that one bothered me more than anybody. Because he's such a good guy. And so I had it in my mind, if I ever get to a place where I can't make a business, this guy. And when I got out, what I'm going to tell you is not good business, but it's good business if you're trying to do amends. That I had that on my mind. I borrowed the money to go pay the money that I ripped off. That's not good business, unless you're in the recovery business. And so I went over there. I was confident everybody would just leap on me because I'd wrecked one of their trucks. I took off the money. Anyway, I expected bedlam. Walked in, the old secretary was still there. And I told her who I was. She didn't even remember me. I was kind of hurt. Didn't remember me at all. So I said, well, you suppose I could see Mr. Brown, the guy that owned the place? And she said, well, he's a very busy man. I said, well, tell him it's about some money that I owe him. And she said, well, maybe I can get you in. So she goes over, and he agrees to see me. I go in, and he wasn't as bad as Alvin, but he was sort of a small man. And had a huge desk, and you could see this little guy sitting behind that desk, horn-rimmed glass. So I went in, he didn't remember me either. So I told him what I was there for, and that I had skipped town and owed him some money, and I wanted to make it right. And he said, well, I appreciate your coming, but honestly, I don't need that money, and I don't want it. I said, well, I'm glad you're all right like that, but I need to pay you. And he said, it would screw up my books. And I said, well, I'm sorry about your books. And then I remembered to tell him what my mission was. You know, I just told him, he thought I was just a creditor making good. He didn't know I was a guy trying to live, you know. And so I said, well, let me tell you what I'm doing. And I told him I was an AA. And part of our recovery depended on amending those things in the past that create a tremendous amount of guilt. And so when he finally got the message, he reached up, took those horn-rimmed glasses off. Now, he was a fine, fine man. He said, well, I'll be darned. I've been in business 40 years, and I have never seen anything like this. I said, me either. This is my first time. And so... But you see the joy of amends in something like that, eh? He took the money. I don't know if he threw it in the trash can. That's none of my business. But what I did was what I needed to do. From then on, I knew that I traveled a lot back then driving. And every time I'd go to Charlotte, there was a certain restaurant where he had lunch, like the favorite place. And so I would always go over there and have lunch. And if he would see me, yeah, busy businessman in the biggest city in our state. If he spotted me, he'd come over there. His code was, now how's that work of yours going? I said, it's great. Get him. That's amends, eh? Restoration. That's what that's about. So a lot of that stuff that just is the freeing things. And if you drag that stuff forever, man, it's a heavy load. And it's so easy to get rid of, eh? Just by taking the action. And some of the difficult ones were it's why it's so important to have that plan and know exactly what you're going to try to do. Yeah, my mother, yeah, I described her as a pretty formidable woman. And she was, but she was a studying contrast. She's not only a domineering type of woman, but she was an extremely loving woman. I honestly believe I could have stayed drunk at her expense for the rest of my life, provided I'd stay at her house. She was that kind of mother. And I'm confident that would have happened. Because she just overloved. She just loved too much. And So when I started to make amends to her, she didn't want to hear it. She did not want to hear it. And I almost had to hold her to make her listen to me make amends. And every time I'd tell her something I wanted to make amends about, she would say, "Now, son, you weren't that bad." I said, "I know, I was worse." But she couldn't believe it. I'm her little boy. That's one thing you have to understand about mothers. Their children are always children. I don't care if they're 80 years old. They're still my boy, you know. And so she never did believe I was an alcoholic. I was at home with her one day, and a neighbor was sitting there. And the neighbor said, I could hear him. Maybe I was in the next room. Said, "What on earth does your son do that he travels so much?" And she said, "Oh, he's in that AA thing." And the neighbor said, "Oh, is he an alcoholic?" She said, "Oh, no. No, no." He was always a good boy. God, what are you going to do with that? You know, what you got to do is plow through it. You know, and I was dealing with her one day about something. I admired a picture she had on the wall. I said, "That is really a lovely picture." She said, "Well, you ought to like it." That's why. She said, "You sent it to me." And apparently I got drunk somewhere and sent her a photo. I did a beautiful painting. I didn't know I had that good taste. It was really wonderful. And one day she said, "Now, son, you really weren't that bad. You sent me all that money." And that really caught my attention. I said, "What money?" And apparently, I told you I wasn't a wonderful soldier. I wasn't a very conscious soldier either. Apparently, they had a place you could sign up to send part of your little piece of money to the family. And they sent money to her the whole time they had me captured in the army. When she told me that, my first thought was, get the money. You know, I didn't mean to do that. But anyway, it's just kind of tough stuff. And particularly with that. And in almost every case, I literally just had to hold them. Because folks didn't want to hear it. And the closer, the more difficult is what I found. And it was always that wanting to just sort of reassure you and say, there, you're not that bad. You just keep doing what you're doing. That's wonderful for them, but it has nothing to do with amends. And what I got to do is what I have to do to make it right. Sometimes you overdo it. Now, when I started being gainfully employed legally and I had a burst of amends one time, and I thought about how really bad I had abused that woman. We lived at a little town where my sister still lives there. Only time I get homesick is when I go home, and I get sick real quick when I go home, and I get out of town real quick when I go home. I wouldn't live there on a bed. Well, I assumed if I didn't like it, who else would? I mean, my family's not going to like it. So I assumed that my mother didn't like living there. She never had said that, but it was just my judgment. So I decided to buy her a house. So I went up there, and I was going to sneak up on her. And I said, "Well, Mom, the town's growing." I said, "Man, you got a lot of building." I said, "Let's drive around and take a look." So I'd take her to all the housing areas. I'd already cased them. I'd go by and say, "Isn't that a beautiful place? How you like that?" You know, she'd tell me. So we got through with it, and I said, "Now, Mother, was there any place that you liked better than any place else we looked at?" She said, "Well, not particularly." I said, "That was all nice." I said, "Well, is there any of them that you would want?" She said, "No." So I had to quit beating around the bush. I said, "Look, I want to buy you a house." And she said, "I don't want a house." I said, "Why not? I mean, my God, anybody living here would want out." She said, "I like where I am." Well, it never dawned on me that my values are not the same as everybody else's. She valued the neighborhood. She valued the people she knew. she valued knowing everybody in that community. But I'm going to impose something on her. And so there's a sensitivity in that's necessary as well, that I can't impose my amends at somebody else's expense. And so that's what I found in doing amends, that they're tremendously vital. But if I wait for folks to do it, you know, to be ready and responsive or send for me, ain't going to happen. Got to remember that it's my recovery that I'm dealing with. And it's about getting away from those burdens that I carry that's owing out of the guilt and shame for what I've done to people. And that's what it is. It's a selfish act in the long run. It's a very selfish kind of an act. And I tell you what, one of the most awkward situations I ever had. Well, when you turn the tables, eh? When I went to another state a few years ago, I won't name it because what I'm going to mention might be identifiable. I don't want to do that. Now, a guy called me from there, and he said, "You're coming here," and I said, "Yeah," and he said, "Can I get about 2 hours with you while you're here?" And I said, "Well, of course, man, we'll have plenty of time." He said, "Well, I'd like to do that," and I said, "Well, when I get in, just come on down to the room." So he came down, and this is a fine young man, came in, and we visited for just a minute, and he said, "Now, Tom, the reason I'm here, I have to make amends to you." I said, "For what?" Well, now I'm careless about stuff. If I don't get reimbursed for this trip, I probably wouldn't even know the difference. I would not say that in front of Richard, but probably wouldn't even know the difference. And I'd gone out there two or three years earlier, and he was the guy who was handling the money. He was the treasurer. And when he was going to reimburse me, and somehow he missed, and the longer he held the money, the more attached he got to it. And he never heard anything from me, and I never gave it a thought. So he's carrying my money for two or three years, and ate him up. And so that's what he wanted to talk to me about. And so he told me what he'd done. And I said, "Well, look, why don't we just count that a donation to the conference? I mean, my God, I didn't even know I had lost it." No, he said, "You didn't lose it. I stole it." I said, "Well, I didn't even know it was gone." And he said, nope, I need to make the amends. And I understood that he did need to do that. But it's awkward, and I understand how people feel when somebody comes in to make amends and it's uncomfortable to deal with. But I'm real proud of that guy. He's a fine leader of AA in that state, a fine leader. So it's a tricky kind of a terrain in dealing with amends. And what I have to keep in mind is that what I'm dealing with are those things that are going to bring about good, solid recovery with me. So I can be at peace. And so I don't have stuff that is nagging at me and dragging at me all the time. The amends, some of it, just like I mentioned about some of my zeal in AA, obviously, and it's probably true of other people, that sometimes the positive actions can be a way of sort of balancing things a little bit, And so that's clearly a big part of what I am. And so to me, these steps are the real keys to freedom and the real joy, so that I can honestly get. In that little preliminary part in the explanation of 8 and 9 in the book, a good passage in there that describes what this is about. And it says something like, well, of course we're working on ourselves. Of course we're dealing with our problem. But our real purpose is what? To be of maximum service to God who knows about us. That's what it's about. It's so I can be fit to be a decent spokesman, a decent representative, a decent example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as long as I'm working both sides of the street and I got two agendas going on, I'm not going to be much of a messenger. And so that, to me, is what this is about, and it's what it's all about in the book, to prepare myself to be of maximum service. Other thing that this does is gets me tuned up for what follows. And now, this is just my reading, of course. But just a little bit of a preview of what the guys are going to get into a little later. Interesting to me that when you get through with 9, and then you take a look at those promises that sound like you just won the lottery or something. I mean, those are spectacular promises. And it says if you're painstaking, that means you really do it to the detail. If you're painstaking about this phase of our recovery, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And then it names those impossible dreams that'll happen. They'll begin to happen. And then the thing that strikes me after that, and why this amends in having a clear conscience and being able to look the world in the eye and not have to be looking at knees and navels all the time, you know, that you actually meet the world, like Bill said, you'll be able to meet anyone on earth and look them in the eye. And I thought he was kidding, but he's not, because today, I don't know of one place on earth that I would have to be uncomfortable meeting any human anywhere. That's freedom. That's freedom. And that's what this produces. And then what it sets up, what's described in those promises as starting to happen. Interesting to me that when you leave the promises, you know, and it's got that little line that we've developed to chant, not we, but some have developed a chant around about it. You'd be amazed before you're halfway through. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. From that point, from the end of the promises to the end of the book, every single thing in there starts with me and never, never, never ends with me. You don't get rid of a self-centered condition by working on self. So now we're free. By this time, we're free. We're able to get our mind on somebody else, pay attention to somebody else's need, and be of maximum service. And that's not slavery. Right now, I'll just tell you this, and I'm a practitioner of what I preach. I don't want you to get this around too much, particularly don't tell Roop. I am 77 years old. God, that's old. That is old. I ought to be decrepit. And I don't walk fast. And I climb stairs even more slowly. I drag up stairs. But I guarantee you my spirit's on fire. I'm as active as I have ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous since day one. Wouldn't have it any other way. I don't know the word no. If I say no to a request, you can bet it's because I simply can't do it. If it's a serious request, you know, like let's go to Starbucks and have some coffee. I don't mean that. But I mean, if it's a commitment to do some service somewhere, no is not in my vocabulary. Unless I've got genuine reason to say that. I'm the most active guy I know. And have been for as long as anybody I know. And I'll guarantee you I'm not a dedicated idiot. What I've found is that when I do what is laid out in 10, 11, and 12, get my mind off myself and try to look at how I can be of maximum effectiveness to God knows around me, that self-centered thing just sort of dies down. And I start to live in the world of the Spirit. And I start to enjoy life unbelievably. And so that's what it's about. It's not about drudgery and pain. It's about getting rid of that stuff and then letting life flow in. And today, I guarantee you, I live in a pretty darn nice world. A pretty nice world. And having more fun than, you know, I can't believe it. I can't be that old. Somebody lied to me. That is truly old. I wouldn't believe it, except I know about as many doctors as I do AA members. But so far, they're doing a good job. And so the only thing I'd say to you, I know that some of you are weasened veterans and some of you are fairly new here. What I'm telling you is the truth. And what I've said to you in this last few minutes is where the joy comes from. And if you think it's going to come from weenie roasts and swimming parties and this kind of stuff, you can thump it up. It's going to come from getting mind off self and then really getting dedicated to being an agent of change for folks around us. And the joy is unlimited. The only thing I just leave you with this thought. Some people will tell you, and if they tell you, I would encourage you not to believe it for one second. Some people will tell you that there's a predictable cycle that we go through in recovery. When you come in, that you'll go through the period of confusion and doubt and fear and all that. And then when it starts to work, you'll tend to get elevated to sort of a fifth dimension or something. You sort of get on a pink cloud in your honeymoon period. And folks, if you listen, some folks will tell you that that runs a fairly predictable cycle. And then it'll tail off into something. I'm not sure what. The reason I'm not sure what is because it has never happened to me. So if anybody tells you that's predictable, don't believe one word of that. What happens, the joy that comes lasts exactly as long as I practice the things that make it happen. The minute I stop doing that, down we go. And that's why I'm wildly active. I'm not a dedicated idiot. You know, I'm just somebody who loves that feeling of useful purpose. So I can go to bed at night and I don't have to do inventory about what I did wrong. I just count my deep gratitude for all the stuff that's happened to me during the day. That's the kind of life I want. Yeah, so thanks.